You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Friday, 10 July. We had Japanese PPI year-on-year out earlier this morning, 7.1%. That is an ouch number. I am Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from MoneyWeb Studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Skelklo, PSG, Old Oak. China, it had a fairly good 2025, and then it's gone all bad in 2026. What's the story here? Of course, the key point for us, China's Tencent is NASPAS's process. And does he still like Remgro, the Mediclinic deal now all nicely done? We're going to be chatting with Kofa's chief Africa economist, the global outlook, but also the local outlook, as our GDP looks set to go sideways again. And thoughts from me, both Meta and XAI have been selling excess data center capacity. Is this a canary in the coal mine for AI build-out or something else entirely? I have some thoughts. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, Discovery Medical Aid, AGM, approves review of benefits for transgender members. In Business Day, Sappi thrills market with update on $500 million revamp of Somerset Mill in the US. Expansion of the facility expected to boost group revenue by as much as $300 million a year. Morning markets, US is green, S&P 0.8% higher, NASDAQ 1.6% higher. The East is mostly green. We've got Sydney up 0.5%, Tokyo 2% higher, Hong Kong almost 2% higher, and Tencent a little lower, 0.3% down. Commodities mostly green. Gold futures, 4,134. Brent oil is the red on the screen, 76.50. Platinum, 1,645. Palladium, 1,274. The rand is 16.28. Bitcoin, 63,800. And top 40 opening call, green open, 280 points, or a little under 0.3% higher.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Skelklo. You find him, of course, PSG Old Oak. Skelk, appreciate the time. I saw something that you actually put out on Twitter the other day. It was a repost and something I was also writing around. If we look at China, it had a really, really good 2025, but it has fundamentally reversed this year. It is lagging quite significantly the rest of its global peers, sort of doing the worst it has since, I mean, all the way back in the early parts of this century. Your thoughts on China? For us, of course, it's a NASPAS process, Tencent. There is a wider story as well. There are other tech and non-tech stocks. Thoughts on the investability and the opportunity?
Good morning, Simon. Yeah, you're talking about tech and non-tech stocks. I think we should sort of rephrase that or recoin it these days from AI to non-AI stocks. I think that's the new term.
Yeah.
Because I mean, bottom line, this is China. I mean, you mentioned 2025. Just go, when you've got time, just go pull a graph and you put the MSCI China, or you can use the Hang Seng against the S&P 500 relative. And you'll see it actually, that relative graph went from the 2000s, it shot up with the S&P 500 struggling there in the mid-2000s, latter part of 2000s. And then just came down like a straight line all the way through to 2025. And you and I had this conversation, I think it was November 2024, where I said, oh man, this is looking attractive relatively. And we had a bit of a comeback. It's a little small blip on the radar. And this year, now trading at the lowest level. So why? I mean, and we can continue this. I mean, I've often had this question when I ask people the question about the MSCI Emerging Market Index, if I ask you the question, which country would you say has got the largest component within the MSCI Emerging Market Index?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would have thought it would be China because I know they're an EM. We can debate. Mm. It's weird that it is, but you would think it would be China.
Yeah. And up to about, let's call it 18 months ago, they carried about a weight of a third of that index. When you look at the 2000s, they carried a weight of 42% of the MSCI And by far the largest component within the MSCI Emerging Market Index. Well, today they're only, it's about 18% weight in the index. They're not even the second largest weight inside the emerging market. They're the third largest. You know, Taiwan, number one, and most recent, the one that's been in the news, Korea, second. And that is mostly AI stocks. And that's the thing. I mean, China, did they really lose? I mean, the forecast is still that they're going to grow their GDP this year by, you know, 4.5%.
Yeah.
So they're still growing. They just do not have the hot topic, namely, you know, big AI companies.
I get your point. Okay, absolutely. And they've got tech. They've got great tech. Maybe just not the tech that everyone is looking for. This is a, if you're not AI right now, it seems you aren't anything. So let's go to something that you and I have chatted about a lot. And in fact, a listener said, next time you chat with Skulk, please ask him about Remgro, the Mediclinic deal now done. The Mediclinic deal broadly means that South Africa or Remgro now owns the local assets, not the offshore assets. Discount still there. A stock, a structure you have long liked.
I love it. I love it. Yeah, I mean, to the listener out there, and Simon knows me well, I'm in my two favorite words in the world. firstly, free, and then my second one is discount. Now, Remgro has always been, you know, been a company in the news, let's call it, past 6 years, where it's traded at a very, very large discount. Now, the discount, when you take it for the past, and I've got about 17-year data, the average discount for this company has been around about the 19% levels. Currently, as we sit here, it's trading at about 38% discount. So this is a company that's trading at more than double the discount, average discount has been trading over the past 17 years. Okay, let's first take, yes, you mentioned it. They now own the Southern African businesses of Mediclinic. Let's take this broader again. When I look at their portfolio, I mean, and we've often had this conversation, you mentioned it, local. I mean, this is as local as it get, and it seems like the strategy for Remgro is now to really focus on local. Yeah, I mean, when you look at the companies, Mediclinic, now purely local. I mean, Outsurance, local company, Discovery, RCL Foods, those type of companies. So it's a company that's, if you've got, you're positive on the local assets, which I still am. Mm-hmm, I mean, when you look at the likes of the Mediclinic, even at the current levels, it's trading at a forward PE of 10 times. So this is a company that's not trading at stretch valuations. And I think with a little bit of a, bit of good news coming out from this company, I think this discount could really get smaller again. And then the final point, I mean, they've been in the news so many times over the past 18 months, well, plus restructuring. They're getting rid of FirstRand. They're doing this Mediclinic. They've got this dark fiber deal with Vodacom. So this is what you typically want to see coming from a holding company. They are active. They're doing things within this company to try and narrow the discount. And I think eventually they will succeed.
And I get your point. It's local. And if you like local, certainly I do, that's a good place to be. We'll leave it there. Skulklo, PSG, Old Oak, always appreciate the early morning time. And our poll today on LinkedIn is just that. Remgro, attractive investment, discount, local, got Mediclinic. Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Sitting with Aruni Achaduri, he's COFIS Chief Africa Economist. The COFIS Risk Review, Country and Sector Risks for June 2026, has just come out. There are 2 points I want to touch on. One is you've downgraded 8 countries, no upgrades. You've made 45 changes to sector assessments, 41 down, only 4 upgrades. This kind of tells the story of where we are as a global economy. And we prefaced before we came on air that things are changing and it could all be different by Monday.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I mean, yes, you know, like all economists, we know that sometimes, you know, our forecasts are not valid for very long. That's just how it is. But, you know, on the bright side, we had said, you know, in this publication that everything was very unsure and that there was basically no guarantee that the situation in the Middle East would significantly improve in the duration. And we were right. But, you know, I don't think that was very hard to forecast.
Yeah.
Anyway, one thing that we can say, and I think that our risk assessments, upgrades and downgrades mirror that, is that we are convinced that the impact of the conflict in the Middle East is going to be felt in 2026 and 2027 in a durable way. And that's because, in any case, no matter what would have happened or what has happened now, we knew that the conflict, the duration was long enough that the impacts would be felt. And so that's why our assessment kind of mirrored that, because on the global economy, we do expect quite a significant slowdown. So, you know, we're at past 2.3% in 2026 at market exchange rate. So that's like around a 0.5 percentage point downgrade relative to before the war, and also 2.5% in 2027, which means that we have, you know, a medium-term slowdown of the global economy. So obviously, with this shock, all countries and all sectors are not going to be affected, you know, in the same way, nor at the same time, because, you know, in case of an energy shock, the transmission to inflation, and then the impact on consumers and corporates, there will be lags. And so that is why we do think that the risk level are going to be worse off, you know, during this year and the next. And that is why we are gone in this direction. And, you know, obviously, we have not excluded the adverse scenario. You know, the market has been very optimistic. We've seen that on oil prices, notably. We were not that optimistic, precisely because we thought that the adverse scenario should not be cast aside, because there was and there is a risk that the conflict intensifies. It's that if that will happen or no, we will see. But we do know that perhaps the lull that we were expecting will not be as long as we had expected, or will, you know, materialize a bit later. And that's unfortunate, but that's the reality of the world we live in, right?
And it's exactly what we've seen in the last couple of days with increased tensions and missile attacks in Iran. But it also talks to the bigger picture. You mentioned there 2026 and 2027. In other words, someone looking right now and thinking, you know what, ultimately President Trump wants to make peace, ultimately oil prices coming down, but the impact is still going to be felt over the rest of this year into next. I'm thinking inflation. Sure, my fuel price might come down, but some of that's kind of got baked into the numbers for now.
Yes, I mean, as you were saying, like, yes, the fuel prices might come down, but the transmission of the shock across, you know, different portions of the economy, that will not happen immediately. In fact, we can say that the shock, because the conflict has re-intensified, that the shock is not over yet, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we thought it would be kind of, it's a pause, it's a break, but it's not over. So one thing is that, yes, the fuel price will most likely be lower, first of all, lower than expected this year, unless there's an intensification, and also lower than expected next year. So that obviously means that, you know, you will have inflation that will start coming down in 2027, but it's always with a lag. And so consumers will experience higher prices in most economies around the world this year and at the beginning of the next year. Yeah. And then we also have to look at the balance sheets, basically, of countries, of consumers, and of corporates. Because one thing is that while this inflationary shock might not be as strong in terms of peak as the one, for instance, that we experienced in Ukraine, we also have to realize that the balance sheets, basically the cash flow of economic agents, are in a much worse position, because we have had several years of crises. Yeah. We have had the tightening of monetary policy. This means that for companies, basically, they still have to keep reimbursing debt that were contracted at higher levels. Even in the case of the inflationary shock, for some sectors, you know, the pricing power or the margin that they have to increase prices is not that high, because demand is still low. So that means that while the shock might be less important, like on a very absolute basis, the room to absorb the shock is actually lower. And that is also true about countries, because the fiscal space of most countries has been eroded because of all of the intervention that was needed during the pandemic, after the war in Ukraine, during the monetary tightening, and also because, well, countries have been basically spending too much in the past two decades. So that means that there's also less room to intervene and to support the economy if required. And this is also true of consumers. So we're seeing in some advanced economies that, first of all, consumers are wary of the future because everything is very chaotic and uncertain. Yeah. So they tend to save more, consume less. And so those impacts and the effect that we'll have on the economy on the broader sense, on insolvencies, for instance, on the capacity to contract debt, that will actually materialize later. And that is why we're saying that even in 2027, while the immediate impact of the shock might be absorbed, balance sheets basically will still not be under pressure.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about it. And even just at a consumer level, that balance sheet. As a last question, to bring it back to South Africa, and particularly the GDP, we were, and maybe we were naive, but as a country, we came into 2026 with a fair bit of hope and optimism, particularly around our GDP. To be clear, not the 3, 4, 5% we really need, but maybe a 1.8 or maybe a 2%. And you've come out, I mean, your forecast is 0.8 for this year and 1% for next year. We're an economy that remains, frankly, stuck in a zero growth environment.
Yes, I mean, that has been real of the South African economy for decades now. Yes, I mean, you know, we were expecting, and I was also expecting some momentum before the crisis. But the issue with South Africa is, first of all, it's an emerging economy. Mm-hmm. It's the most developed on the continent. So basically, when you have an energy shock, it is actually relatively more affected than less developed countries, because the industries do depend on oil transport. You know, all of the exporting industries, commodity, agriculture, these are oil-dependent industries. So while there has been like no immediate supply disruptions or not very large ones, the price effect still materializes. And when you look, I mean, obviously the Q1 GDP figures, they should be taken, you know, with a bit of caveats, because that's before the beginning of the crisis. The Q1 figures were actually not that bad, but basically the trends that we had seen in the past quarters, those still continue to materialize, which is that basically South African growth is driven mostly by services, a bit by agriculture also, because we were expecting that because the rains had been very good in the La Nina period, but that in the side, on the industrial side, that basically, you know, manufacturing and mining are still stuck with very low demand. And so that will continue into this year, except that if we have an increase in inflation, because the service sector was driven by good consumption because inflation had been very low. That's why the target was changed. So now with, you know, a bit more inflation, you have a bit less consumption. Mm-hmm. But that is also why we are at this stagnant level, in the sense that the shock, it has not highly distorted the growth outlook, because my forecast was actually not that high even before the shock, because I had this under consideration. But it's not, you know, an extremely recessionary shock as well. But I will add that below 1% growth basically means that on the average, the country is continuing to get poorer because the population growth rate exceeds 1.7%. That is the main issue. I will say that on the bright side, though, you know, you had the removal from the FATA gray list. The fiscal situation has improved a bit. The energy system is now more stable. And so, you know, one can only hope that if the reforms continue, despite this shock, that now it will be slightly later, but maybe at the end of 2027 or 2028, we have a slightly stronger momentum. But that is the thing. I mean, the policy, the economic policies that have been implemented, which were good in the past years, have to be continued despite this shock, because that's what will grip the drive. South Africa's economy has been resilient to shocks, but also the resilience is also part of why it stagnates. It's because there's a big distortion into the growth engines, the growth drivers. Yeah. And so some portions of the economy continue to perform. If you have a big financial sectors, I mean, financial flows in this crisis have been very, very large. There's been a lot of transactions. Markets have generally held quite well. So that kind of shows that where the pockets of growth are, and the problem in South Africa is that the pockets of growth are not sufficient to have a stronger growth rate.
Yeah, but like your point, we need to hold the line on those reforms regardless of what's happening. And even it's tough, but we need to continue doing the right thing and not necessarily the popular thing. We'll leave it there. So Sweni Chandra, he's our co-founder, chief Africa economist. Always appreciate the insights. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for 3 decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Some thoughts from me on data center capacity. Let's start back in April 2025, last year. Microsoft CFO said they'd erred by pulling back on spending a new data center rollout, and she promised to increase that spending, and they did. Beginning of this year, all the hyperscalers markedly increased CapEx spend on new data centers to numbers, collectively well over $600 billion from less than $300 billion for 2025. But then last month, XAI, ahead of the, or just as they were doing the listing, announced that they'll be selling excess capacity at their Colossus data center. Now, to be clear, that Colossus is a, well, Colossus data center. But they, Anthropic, is going to be buying $1.25 billion of capacity per month. And the deal runs to May 2029. Alphabet more recently announced they would be spending $920 million a month. And that deal runs through to June of 2029. So these are not short-term deals. These are, call it, 3-year deals generally. And then last week, Meta just announced that they also had spare capacity. So they would also be selling excess data center capacity. And the market loved it and pushed the price higher. But my question is, why do they have excess capacity? I assumed that they wouldn't, right? Building data centers quick enough. There's huge demand. We can't get enough of it. So what is it telling us? Is it that XAI and Meta via Llama have got too much, that they have overbuilt, that demand is not what they expected, or that maybe Grok and Llama are not very good? And it is that point. Patently, for XAI and for Meta, demand is not as expected. is that more broadly an industry issue, or is that more specifically a Grok XAI Llama Meta concern? To be clear, neither Llama nor Grok are anywhere near the frontier models, or even the cheap Chinese models. Data from the Open Router data site shows even French Mistral at 2x what Grok is doing. And Mistral is not a big player in this space. Anthropic is using 50 times what Grok does. So is this a canary in the coal mine over demand, or poor models that are just so far behind the frontier models that nobody uses them? I don't know. Maybe it's a bit of both. I tend to think it's probably weak models. But if AI is a utility, and I think it is fast becoming that, then maybe weak models are fine in time. But it's something to keep an eye on. And certainly, having spare capacity might not be the exciting thing much of the market thinks it is. That's it for today. Chatting with Fahima Edir yesterday from Momentum. Talking leisure stocks, Stats SA data shows increased tourism numbers, hotel occupancies, a lot of that foreigners coming into our country. We asked you, are you holidaying more or less in the past years? Almost half said definitely less. The rest was split between more, if the price is right, and some of you saying, ha, no holidays for you. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The Moneyweb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobuchle, Nicole Sabu, to you for listening. My guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is Moneyweb Now. We'll chat again Monday. Private credit.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.